What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar. This week, joined by podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Going to be talking about things that are agentic, which is a big buzzword in the last few months.
I hate that word so much, but like so many things with the AI buzz, they have created new terms and new things that we have to deal with and fit into our lives. There were several bits of news this week about web browsers doing AI stuff. Opera, Firefox, and the Arc browser company is also doing something new. So we're going to talk about all those things. But really, this is a quiet week for news, and we want to take some time to talk to our listeners. So our live stream listeners will be putting down questions for us to answer. We'll do that in this episode. I also have a question that I wrote up for Ask Engadget that somebody had asked us about how to set up Xboxes for your children. I think that's a fun one. So this is a big Q&A. Q&A and a bit of news. Sit tight, folks. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com, especially if you have questions. If you leave us a question there, that we could answer it on the show, and it could be part of Ask Engadget on the website eventually. And also join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern for our live stream. Sometimes you'll get to participate in fun things like what we're doing, which is whoever's here can just literally ask us anything. And sometimes we'll show off gadgets, too. It's a fun time. Join us. Let's move on to some questions from our audience here. Thank you, folks, on the live stream. We'll be taking a look at your questions. And also, folks, hey, bring us your questions for the podcast. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We want to hear what you're asking. To kick things off, I want to talk a bit about an Ask Engadget article they'll be putting up later this week on the site. Somebody asked us, what's the best way to set up an Xbox for your kid? And there, it turns out that there's an app for that. It's actually pretty easy. The only thing you have to do is you essentially have to create a child account, a Microsoft child account, tie it to your family. You could do that from within the Xbox or websites, I believe. And also there's an Xbox Family Settings app that lets you easily monitor how long your kid is playing, control how long they're playing, deal with friend requests. You can accept friend requests there too. And it'll even generate like playtime reports for you. So you can see what your kids are playing. You can also block off online games and just allow Minecraft. So I feel like, you know, that's cool. For a lot of parents, like this is kind of what you need. I have seen reports that it's kind of messy because it is a very Microsoft level thing where there's multiple layers of permissions and it gets kind of confusing. So I've seen people complain on Reddit that their kids can't play on their Minecraft realms properly because of some permissions issue.
They kind of just
got really fed up with the whole process. So there was like, whatever, kid, I'm just giving you a normal Xbox account. I will manually monitor you. You know, I will make sure you don't play enough and do stuff like that.
I will be walking through the living room often. Yeah. But that does make sense, right? Like Minecraft is as much an online game as it is like a single player thing.
Oh, absolutely.
And in a lot of cases, like kids want to be able to play with their friends and like build stuff with their friends because it's basically Lego. Sitting down with the pile of Legos in the middle between all of you. Yeah, so that can be difficult, but I'm wondering if there is two-factor authentication on this, because I know, as an intrepid youth who tried to get around parental controls...
Well, you're not really... Yeah. With any Microsoft thing, there's always two-factor, so that's a given. The two-factor's in there. All your kid needs to do is essentially just sign in with their account, and they are limited by what you can do. I'd say this is more useful for, like, you know, 8 to 12-year-olds or 12-year-olds who may not be doing much online gameplay or may be doing other stuff. For teenagers, there are controls for teenagers. I don't know how you do that. I feel like that's just they're getting older. I don't know. Let them play the games. I don't see much of a point in like censoring that too much. But that's up to you. It's up to the parents. Yeah, that's a pretty straightforward thing. Ben, how did your parents control your game time?
It was mostly.
Did they ever take away your console or anything?
I grew up in a very small apartment. So one level, there was no such thing as like going downstairs and, you know, you could do as much video game stuff as you wanted downstairs because, you know, the parents were, you know, in the kitchen upstairs or whatever. I grew up in like 1,000 square feet of apartment. My parents were in the
kitchen. You were in Yonkers, right?
Yes. So in the kitchen, like, there was no doors between the kitchen and the living room. So they could basically hear what I was doing. And so, yeah, I'd be able to play video games for a few hours, like, after school, if I got all my homework done, or, you know, all afternoon on a Saturday. But also, there was only one TV. So that was its own limiter. If my parents wanted to watch something, or, like, I was just always aware that, you know, the time could, the plug could be pulled.
There were plugs to pull very easily.
Yes, too, yes, so literally. And then as I got older, I moved to, like, more PC gaming. And so my parents would be able to watch TV, and I was able to, you know, play StarCraft or something. But again, the computer was right there next to the couch.
Yeah, yeah. There's no hiding it. I am thinking about how lucky kids are these days. Like, my daughter, she's big into Minecraft. She only plays it on her iPad. And it was an iPad I bought to be like, hey, this is the family iPad. It ends up being the thing she mainly dominates to play Minecraft when she needs to. But also, it doesn't mess with TV time. She doesn't need to use a whole other device. She could play right near us. So that's kind of useful. And I manually just, like, keep track, like, I think you've been playing too much today. Like, you gotta chill. So there are a lot of ways you could do it. We're not using the Microsoft Family Settings app with her yet, but actually, now that I've wrote this piece, I'm like, maybe we should try it out just so I get some performance monitoring or something, because she doesn't even have her own Microsoft account. She's playing Minecraft on mine. But I do remember there were occasions where, like, my parents would hide my console, where, I don't know, I don't think I was a bad kid who needed to do that at all. My friends, though, their parents would just hide their controllers. Mm. So, like, oh, console's right there. But you did not listen to me today. Like, you were a real piece of work today. So we're taking your controllers, and you can't, the console's there, you can look at it, but you can't actually play anything. And that was kind of diabolical. So we have gone a long way from those days where parents just literally had to, like, yank controls and hide consoles from kids. Now you have an app, kind of useful, done in a very Microsoft way. I'd love to know, if you're a parent and you're dealing with your kids playing games now too, how are you dealing with it? Are you dealing with it at all? Are you letting them have free rein because your parents were too restrictive with you? I've heard all sorts of, like, ways of thinking about this. And
there's,
you
just
know, I did not
so
plan.
Much stuff yeah. that you can get into there's via just, voice chat, too.
Like, there's just so much stuff. Yeah, yeah. But listen, I did not plan to have a Minecraft kid. She just ended up being a Minecraft kid. And I'm not too surprised. Like, she got into Minecraft around the same age where I discovered Super Mario Brothers, and it changed my world. And I was like, oh my God, this is my life. This is my everything now. So, and Minecraft is so much more interesting and so much more flexible. It could be a thing she plays for her entire life at this point, because I've seen people talk about the builds they did when they were kids, and they're full grown adults now. So,
in fact, if you get good enough at Redstone logic gates, you can get a computer that runs the original Mario in Minecraft.
In Minecraft. Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole thing. But what is cool is, like, I was never really into Minecraft. So now I'm playing it with my daughter, and this is a gateway into it, and we're both learning it together, and she's teaching me things. So that's cool. That's the power of gaming, folks. All right. Do we have any questions from the audience? Harry Meyer, you've asked a couple good ones. I hope I'm pronouncing your name properly. But one that they brought up is, do you feel we will give up our screens and keyboards? It depends on what you mean by that. I do feel like for a lot of people, the keyboards are gone, right? Like, a lot of people, you're on your smartphone, you're on your tablet most of the time. You only really use a keyboard for work, for productivity stuff. And I think for a lot of folks, you don't even really get to that. Will we give up screens? I've been thinking about this because there's been a lot of talk about the AI devices that OpenAI and Johnny Ive are working on together. And there were rumors that it was like a little iPod shuffle thing with maybe a camera, maybe a microphone that's just recording you all day. The thing is, you need a screen. you need to see what that thing is doing. Like, you'll need a screen somewhere.
It becomes a question of semantics, though. Like, yes, will there be a screen in the traditional sense in, you know, the monitor that I'm looking at right now? Maybe not. Will there be a tiny little thing in some glasses or maybe even a contact sometime in the future? Yes, there will be a visual display. Whether or not you want to call that a screen is up to you.
I mean, that is still a screen. It's literally a micro LED screen. I'm looking at the latest stuff from X-Real right now. It's a micro LED. It's just really small. It's still a screen. But I don't think we're ever going to be like fully... I'm thinking like the movie Her, which we referred to quite a bit. It is interesting how often there aren't screens, right? Like in that movie, there's like a little computer interface when the guy's doing... His job is writing gift... like. Was it birthday card, like card greeting card messages? What a weird job, but really simple interface. That's the only point where he's in like in front of a computer. I don't think they're staring at their phones. He is walking through and just like talking with this thing, which is totally kind of headless. He plays video games in his apartment with like a projector thing. So like screens become this like very use case focused thing. I think we are kind of getting there, but I don't think we're ever going to give up on screens entirely for our computing. Because you're gonna need something. You're gonna need something to see kind of what the AI agent you're talking to is actually referring to. Screens are kind of just how we're dealing with that right now.
In fact, I don't know whether or not Her is going to end up looking a little bit like a utopia.
Oh, it absolutely does.
Well, yeah, it already did. But I'm talking about just looking like a utopia. You know, in 10 or more years, people are going to be like, look at this one movie with this beautiful aesthetic, and no one is going like this. Nobody has their phone right in front of their face. It's all like beautiful and seamless, and people are having these quiet, loving conversations with AIs that they've gotten too infatuated with.
You know, the real utopia, the movie Her, which I noticed, I think the first time I watched it, there are no jeans in that movie. That movie's all...
They're all slacks and trousers and...
slacks and soft pants and stuff. And where we have come in future fashion is essentially athleisure everywhere. Kind of the same deal, though. Kind of like, jeans are too heavy and they're restrictive. I have soft pants. They're all over the place. That was the real vision of Her. But even
bit Star Trek, too?
It's a little bit Star... Well, that was more like Lycra. I think, we're getting to Star Trek kind of levels of things. Certainly a lot of people are. But with Her, you're walking around with the earpiece. I am kind of doing that. Like with my AirPods Pro, I'm like making breakfast for my kids. I ask Siri a thing. It responds back to me with a thing. Eventually, we'll get agentic AIs that are in our ears. And that's kind of the kind of big thing. But the screens, I think, are going to be more spread out, right? Like, because I was thinking about this. I have a lot of screens in my house. We have the TVs. I have a projector. But also, I'm like rethinking, like, I kind of want a bigger TV in the bedroom just because I rarely get to watch stuff with my wife anymore because she's often too tired dealing with the kids to even come down to the living room to watch stuff. So, like, okay, we're going to fix that screen. But also, there are tablets everywhere. There are smartphones everywhere. There's, like, little... we used to have one of the smart displays on like a kitchen counter back in Brooklyn. I didn't use that here, but it is interesting how we kind of spread screens throughout, and maybe that's part of how we're going to live moving forward too. But the thing in your ear, that's kind of the essential one. So I don't think we're going to lose screens entirely. We will probably lose keyboards though for a lot of people.
That makes sense. And honestly, like, we've been getting prepared for that by sci-fi media for a long time. In a lot of cases, people had little tablets or, you know, they had it like a stylus and a tablet or something. The entire idea of sitting there locked to a specific position with a keyboard is not as fluid as you would hope, because it also doesn't look like having a notebook or anything.
So next question is, Tom Rogers says, wow, who knew Ben grew up in the 80s? I guess barely 80s, right? Barely for you, Ben?
No comment.
Purely 90s kid. Yeah.
I'm just doing not the math the 80s, here. Though. No.
I grew up, I have, you know, vague memories. I was born in 84. So I have like late 80s memories, and it was a time. I saw somebody asking questions about EVs. I want to go back to, yeah, Tom Rogers. You bring up a really good one that I responded to in the chat. He doesn't understand why there aren't small generators that charge batteries on the go in EVs. A 5-gallon tank with a small engine could give hundreds of miles of range. That is happening right now. I researched the BMW i3, which has a range extender that they call it, which is literally, it's a scooter engine with like 2 gallons of gas so in the back. And it doesn't run the car, but if your battery gets low, it goes put, 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 put. It starts in the back and just like slowly charges up the battery. I hear it's a terrible experience, but there are cars in China that are doing this more. And I believe some are actually going to be coming to the US.
I mean, honestly, that makes a lot more sense, though, because like the scooter engines are just so much more ubiquitous around there, too.
But they're really bad. They actually, those things generate a lot more toxins than like a typical car engine. It was a whole thing. But apparently it's allowed in the BMW i3. I was really intrigued by that thing. I really wanted to get one. But
from an engineering perspective, that's such a smart way of using parts that are already there, that are already available. You already have mechanics that know how to service those engines. And you're just like, okay, it's in a car rather than on a bike.
Mm-hmm. So we are seeing a lot of plug-in hybrids, mostly out of China. I think Toyota's bringing some here. But essentially, it's a plug-in hybrid, but the gas does not power the car. The car is purely electric. The gas generates power for the electric engine. You're not having like a traditional engine in there. And that's kind of interesting. So, and those cars are getting like hundreds of more miles of range than typical other things. The whole point though is to like stop using gas. And my family needs a second car. I'm looking at a used Volkswagen e-Golf right now, which are selling used between $10,000 and $15,000. Ridiculous.
How do you feel about buying a car that the value has fallen off so much?
I know why the value has fallen off. It's because it's an EV and a lot of that tech is older and people don't want small batteries. I just need a car for like my suburb, like maybe occasionally jump into Atlanta. So even the low mileage e-Golf, which is like 80 miles, it's fine. Atlanta's 10 miles away from me. And the slightly better one where they upgrade the battery, it's like 130 miles. Perfect. It's actually great. And for a lot of people, they don't need a ton for their commute. So old charging tech, old EV tech just depreciated really quickly. I know exactly why. That doesn't make them bad cars. It just means they won't charge as quickly as, you know, as newer EVs.
I've had so
many, have as much range.
So my dad worked for the city where we grew up, or where I grew up, for a long time. I kept on telling him, hey, if you have some control over whether or not businesses put in chargers, I think that you should try to get a stipulation into zoning or any of the other city laws that say that if you are doing some significant change to either the building or the parking lot, that automatically triggers a thing where you need to put in like 5 charging spots. Because I think that ends up being smart in the long run. I'm not even saying that you need to put in solar in order to service those charging spots. I'm just saying if you'd make any kind of a big change to your parking lot, not repaving, that's too easy. But if you're putting in like a couple of extra spaces or something larger than it used to be, immediately you have to put in 5 charging spots, because then you have the situation that you're in where you might have a small battery EV, or someone is going to the grocery store and they just want to top up their charge a little bit. And in the 20 or so minutes that they might be in the grocery store, you can get like 5 or 10% battery. That sounds like a good thing to me.
Out in the suburbs, out here in the suburbs of Atlanta, that's what I'm seeing, Ben. I'm seeing almost every grocery store parking lot, a couple pop up, a couple charging stations pop up. And I think in the future, we're going to have like easier to deploy charging stations with, like, hey, solar is really cheap. A solar panel is really cheap. The problem is they're still not as efficient as we'd like them to be. They need to bring in more energy. But it would be cool if somebody made an all-in-one EV charger that had a decent like solar umbrella to like collect some concentrated light, had its own battery, and can, you know, actually charge people whenever they need to. So put that out there. I see a good question from Mo Esquire. Thanks for sending it in. It's about producing a remote podcast. They're interested in starting a podcast devoted to examining artist discographies using DaVinci Resolve and Zoom. Can you share some tips? Oh, do we have tips? Do we have tips? It really depends, because my God, when I started podcasting in 2008, it was rough out there. It was basically Skype and USB headsets, because there were not many great USB microphones that plugged into computers. And we recorded the Skype broadcast and we produced that as a pod. It sounded terrible. Now you could do it all on the internet, and it's kind of wild. So for video, what we're using right now on our live stream is Video Ninja, video.ninja, which is something that our old video producer, our old live stream producer, Julio, turned us on to. It is all web-based. You log in, it's like a video chat, and it gives you basically feeds that you can plug into OBS or wherever to broadcast. So do you just want to record a show? Do you want to broadcast the show? What do you think of doing? How many people are coming in?
I'm still Video bummed Ninja. That we can't use Google Hangouts for this. This seems like a perfect utilization for Google Hangouts.
This is why I don't trust Google for anything. I don't trust Google's XR. I don't trust, like, Google will never actually deploy to something. Video Ninja being run by one guy is a really cool little tool. But I also know a lot of people who have to produce other shows. Riverside.fm is something I'm seeing a lot of podcasters use, both in terms of a lot of these things. Riverside and Zencaster, which I use for the Filmcast, you log into a website, you record through the website, it records a file locally, and that's the key. So it's recording your local audio, which sounds great. It's not recording the stream, which is audio sent to the internet, compressed, comes back down, sounds terrible. Local audio is what you want. Use one of those tools. They can do video, they can do audio, and then I've seen people set up Riverside to go straight to Twitch channels or Discord channels, Discord rooms, and also straight to web streaming as well. So I'm actually, we should look closer at Riverside. It just costs money. The thing about Video Ninja is it's totally free. If you figure out Video Ninja plus OBS and have somewhere to spit out those streams, you're golden. So I'd recommend that.
Mm-hmm. And I would say the reason that we do the sync at the beginning of each episode is because I prefer using locally recorded audio at all times. And so if you want to do a video component to your show, which a lot of people do these days, I very much suggest using local audio on the video. And so you're still going to need to do that same sync, because what you'll end up doing is taking the video portion of stuff, syncing the locally recorded audio with picture, and then going on from there. Then you have a product that is that much higher quality for your listeners, and I think they will appreciate it a lot.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, the thing has been, I know you're a purist, you want always the local stream. Riverside, Zencaster, everything, they're recording. They record local video as well.
It sounds like diet soda to me. I know. Yeah, I'm persnickety. Yeah. This is the website for people to get persnickety. Definitely. About tech things,
though. If you want to get persnickety, I will say, if you're just getting started, if you have no clue what you're doing, if you just want the easy mode is using one of those things, Riverside or Zencaster or whatever, and getting it out there. Medium mode is using something like Video Ninja to master it all. And then hard mode is also, at the same time, do a manual local recording, and then you're syncing stuff in timelines and doing all that fun stuff. Anything else you want to add, Ben?
No, I would say vaya con Dios.
Good luck. Good luck, and send us the link to your podcast. It is a rough time to be doing podcasts right now. Trust me, I know, in many, many ways. I see another question from Harry Meyer, which kind of points to something we've been talking about. Why can't the Xbox be like a home computer? Don't they have the power of running a Chromebox, essentially? Let me tell you, they have a lot of power. They have a lot of power of basically a low-level gaming PC at this point. And that is something we talked about at the end of last year, as Microsoft was looking at the future of the console market, and the PlayStation 5 Pro came out. Everybody's gunning for the Switch 2. And the question is, what does Microsoft do? The rumors are Microsoft is going to create some sort of handheld. they'll probably create some sort of like powerful next gen console, but they don't need to do a mid-range. They don't need to do like a mid generation console. They don't need to do a Pro because nobody's buying the Xbox Series X. More people are buying the Series S, but still underpowered. That Xbox Series X could be a great Windows computer. And that's the thing I was thinking of. Like, they raised the price of that thing because of tariffs and everything. But still, even at $600 or more, a little box that can play decent games and, you know, run Windows, like, to me, that is actually pretty useful. It would be kind of cool if they did that. I hope they do that. That would be fun. Just let people turn their Xboxes into Windows boxes. It's not hard. Come on.
So thanks, everybody, for the mailbag. This was fun. It's nice to be able to do this every now and then. Again, if you have any other questions you want to ask, something that came up as you were listening to the episode, you can email us at podcast@engadget.com.
All right, let's move on to other news. And weirdly, I don't know why this happened, but the browsers really seem to be thinking about AI. The browser companies in general. There's news from Opera that's launching a new fully agentic browser. There was some controversy about Firefox testing out AI previews. And also the browser company, the company that made Arc, is also leaving the Arc browser behind in exchange for a fully AI browser type of thing. I was a bit baffled that all these things hit at once. Like, did you have any, just seeing this news in general, Ben, did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I have some bigger like news analysis ideas, but let's go through things point by point before we get to like the larger bit of it. So, okay, Opera is talking about a fully agentic browser that can surf the web for you. What does that mean?
So agentic AI is the thing we're going to be hearing about more. It's sort of like it's a thing you talk to. It's like a more alive chatbot. It's a more responsive type of chatbot. So far, we've seen AI basically be in the form of a search engine, right? Like it's a text field and it replies back with questions. Sometimes you can drop a picture. Sometimes you can ask it voice questions. But it's a very like basic thing. The whole thing about agentic is that it's going to be a little more helpful. I think it's just like a super powered version of what we're seeing right now. But that's something Microsoft wants to pursue with how Copilot works. It's certainly going to be a way they think of Siri moving forward too. And also the Google thing. Google's AI stuff is going to follow similar things. A better AI.
In fact, though,
responds directly to your needs.
Like yeah. Google was the thing that debuted the functionality that I think that people talk about when they talk about agentic things, because it's not just the fact that it's a chatbot. It's the fact that you can say, hey, can you go do this 3 or 4 step task? Something that I saw on social media recently was some tech person saying, I want an agent that I can say, I would like to plan a kid's birthday party. Somewhere within 5 miles from my house, here is a budget of $500. You are allowed to spend like $500 on, you know, whatever linked credit card. And it will take however long it needs to take and go off and do that as if it was an assistant or an agent working on behalf of you.
Think of what a travel agent does. Think of what like any of those types of things used to do. Yeah.
So what does it mean to be an agentic web browser? Is this something that you can say, hey, I've always wondered about this or this, or honestly, a college student saying, hey, I would like you to write a 15-page paper for me on these themes using these sources, so on and so on. Take as long as you need, make it actually good rather than have it pop up before my eyes the way ChatGPT often does. And
it's basically
I want to come back
work.
And find it sometime yeah. later.
If you remember that game, was it called Minion or Minions? One of those. But it was like Xbox 360 game where like you were the super powerful overlord and you just commanded your little creatures to go out and attack or do things. It's essentially what we're doing here. AI Minion, go forth and find me research.
Can you yeah. remind me of the Google service that was unveiled a few years ago. This must have been like 2016, 2017. This was the first thing where you can ask Google to go off and make dinner reservations for you. That was like, that made some real ripples. And I feel like that's a progenitor to anything you call agentic today.
I think that was just the Google Assistant. Yeah, it was Google Assistant making bookings to make appointments. And we've talked about that here and how I think this is like where we started to see a lot of the problems that are going to be cropping up with AI. It's like, I felt that was such an inhuman thing to be doing, because those poor restaurant, the people working at the restaurants, dealing with reservations or whatever all day, and now they get this weird robot voice asking them things, and you don't know what's happening. They don't understand what's happening to them. I felt that was really unfair and inhuman. And hey, these AI bots will be able to do that for you with everything. So let's specifically talk about the news here.
Okay, but Opera Professor Panda Bear in the chat says that it was Duplex. Yes, that's right.
Duplex. Duplex was the name of it. Eventually, Duplex turned into something that was in Google Assistant. I hated all those things. And I've talked to people who've run restaurants who are like, I don't know why this weird robot voice is talking to me now. And like, I owe it something, right? I did not sign up to take orders from a robot today. You know, it's sort of like that. Opera announced a new browser that they're testing called Neon. Opera Neon, a browser for the agentic web. I'm going to play the video for it here. Actually, really well-produced video, because it's just a robot talking about, well, what is an AI agent? How do I work? What do I do? The basic gist of it, though, is that it's going to be a web browser that does not look like a web browser. Let me find the screenshot that they're talking about here. I believe, yeah, it's just like a blank screen. And what you see, it's options to do, make, create, something like that. And you're basically using it like any of the AI assistants right now, but you don't have the traditional browser interface. It's just going forth and doing stuff for you. I'm not surprised that Opera is doing this, just because this is where the hype is. I am surprised that both Opera and the browser company essentially announced that they're doing the same thing at the same time. And this is probably something we're going to see more of.
And I also had no idea that the browser company, the full name is the Browser Company of New York. And it has
the,
old style font, as if it was like charitable foundation or, you know, something established in the 1910s or earlier than that.
Like an old school brewery or something.
And so the browser company has been like adopting AI. It has been embracing AI, I think, a lot more than other browsers. Also, being that they are smaller, how can you differentiate yourself from the, you know, huge super yachts of the other browsers? Yeah, you can be a little bit faster. You can be a little bit more nimble.
You could totally be more nimble. It's Opera's the same way, right? They're a small company. They've been around forever, but they are a pretty small company compared to Mozilla and everybody else. Let's focus, though, on what's happening here with Opera, because Opera Neo is the one we can actually see. You can sign up to test it right now. The interface is fairly basic. There's options to chat, do, make. That's the basic thing. So chat like an AI bot, do actually do assignments. We're seeing here in the demo video, they're asking to do a thing called plan a guided hike near Bergen and find the cheapest train tickets from Oslo. And then we see it do things like it's searching through, it's finding, planning the hike, purchasing train tickets. Who knows like how much of this it'll actually be able to do. But the idea between this and also what the browser company is talking about, and the browser company specifically is launching another thing. What's the name of that?
It's called Dia, yes.
Dia. And it's the same deal. They're not, there's a whole blog post from the browser company that we wrote up.
They're basically saying, like, we're going to be doing security updates, but not very much more for Arc, which is a big bummer for about 15 people. Otherwise, I think it makes sense if they are thinking about the long-term longevity of the company. But we don't know very much about what's going on with Dia right now. I think
that whole blog post is kind of weird, because it's sort of like, hey, we screwed up a bit because the Arc browser is this cool thing that nobody really knows how to use. Like it has a really core audience, but it's not going to grow beyond that. and they want to make something simpler that doesn't feel like you have to be an expert to know how to use it, basically. So that feels kind of like what Opera is doing. It is simplifying the work of finding stuff on the internet and doing stuff on the internet. That seems like the basics of it, right?
And right now they're doing a lot of finger waving, just saying like, ooh, the next thing is going to be amazing and powerful and use AI, pretty much just like any other company working on their new AI, whatever it is. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing for the browser company to be doing, but it is a path that we've seen, or a strategy that we've seen happen a lot recently.
It is. It's really funny. So I would say go read that blog post from the browser company's CEO, Josh Miller. It's really weird because it's sort of like a mea culpa of like, yeah, hey, we should have shut this down. We should have shut Arc down a year ago. I should have been more excited about AI and not be so hesitant about it. And it seems like a guy who's seeing the whole industry kind of move around him to tap into AI features, and he feels kind of guilty that they have not. And maybe there are some things they could be doing. There's a weird push and pull right now, Ben, between the criticism of AI, which I think, and specifically generative AI, because of what they're trained on, because of the environmental impact, because of the whole like theft of it all, they're being built on copyrighted materials typically. But also, in some cases, they can be useful. And we're trying to figure out like what that balance is. And I think we're in a weird place. Personally, I'm like, I don't want to use stuff coming from OpenAI. I don't trust OpenAI. I don't trust Anthropic that much either now, especially. I've been reading Karen Howe's book, Empire of AI, and it is wild how I did not realize Anthropic was like such a close philosophical connection to OpenAI. Like, it's from people who used to work there. These companies are filled with a lot of people who are thinking about AI in ways that are weirdly religious, like sort of like they are treating it like a new religion. So it's sort of when we see these things being announced as features, as like services, I don't know when to trust them. I don't know if you have any different feelings at this point, Ben.
I mean, I have a lot of feelings that are not very well articulated, so I don't think it's good to put them on the live stream public record. But I will mention the fact that...
The AI will remember, Ben. Yeah.
I just don't want to wake the basilisk, you know? But I will mention, you were talking about the theft of AI that is up for courts to figure out. In many cases, courts have said that there is some theft going on. But I will also say that, remember, we also had this little bit of news cross the radar screen that Nick Clegg, who was at Meta for a very long time, said, basically, if you had to go out and ask every single artist whether or not you could use their copyrighted material, we would never get AI to work.
Yeah, and a lot of people online are saying, good. Okay, that sounds like your problem, not our problem, not culture's problem. You know, it's not the artist's problem, certainly.
Without getting too like sidetracked, because I do want to get to like the news analysis of like all the browser stuff. I think I have something interesting to say there. Part of learning, if you want to teach a computer to actually do stuff, is teaching them the rules and then having them do stuff based on the rules, not based on other pieces of copyrighted material. You know, music has rules.
What are the rules?
Music has rules. Here are all of the tones. Here's the major and minor scales. Here's how they connect with, you know, relative major and relative minor. Go off and make something de novo.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of different because what these things are doing, like especially generative AI, it is a thing that deconstructs what is already known. So to do that, it has to see what already exists. It's not, you can't just teach it the rules and have it like go off and create a symphony. It kind of works backwards in a way. It learns through osmosis, and then at the end you have something that can kind of produce stuff with, you know, a search string or whatever. And for a lot of people, that's kind of miraculous. But I also think we are just barreling towards this thing. Reading Empire of AI, it really makes it clear, like, OpenAI and a lot of people were just like sweating for years, like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, Microsoft gave us $1 billion, we gotta do something. And they just kind of stumbled into these models. Like, other AI researchers, we've talked about folks like Timnit Gebru, who have been researching this field for a while were always really trepidatious because of the downsides of AI and like the bad things that could come up. When you build a big model, it's built on material that is often racist and sexist. It is all the stuff that exists on the internet. And if you don't think about how you're building a thing, a black box that learns from that and how to take out the bad stuff, then you're kind of, you're not really doing a service to humanity. You're actually creating this thing that could be incredibly dangerous. And we've seen that happen again and again, even back to like something like that AI chatbot Microsoft announced or released, Tay, which was immediately like people just started making it say, I believe, racist and sexist things. That was a huge disaster because they didn't know how to like curtail all that stuff. So anyway,
yeah, getting back to browsers for a second.
What we're seeing here, I mean, this is all connected. This is a browser entirely based on like the stuff AI can give you, having it research like an AI thing. Would you trust your browser to do that? It doesn't seem like these things have a manual mode, right? This is like, it's sort of like the difference between having even like a manual or automatic car or one that is fully self-driving and will just take you to where you need to go. But maybe you want to sightsee. Maybe you want to take a specific route. Maybe you want to like have a spur of the minute change. It seems like for these browsers, you don't have direct control over a lot of what these agents are doing. So that is kind of interesting. Just wild.
And then as the Firefox guy, I'll just get to the Firefox a bit. I yeah. went to Firefox Labs. I enabled their like AI link previews. They're fine. I like having link previews in general. I don't want to have a link preview every time I hover over, which is great because you actually have to press a couple keys down on this new Firefox function. It will bring up the link preview as if, and I'm pretty sure the link preview is something that has existed for a while now. It's just something that I never enabled. And then right under that, with a little sparkle icon, because that is the AI emoji AI now, it has key points. And if you give it a second, it will read the link and tell you some key points about this. Now I think it's the time when we can scale up to talk about whether or not this kills the concept of links. I don't see this Firefox link preview with some key points. I don't see that killing links. What do you think?
Well, the whole point is you're previewing this thing. Hey, give me a quick summary. Give me the gist of what's in this link. Oh, got it. I'm not going to click that link, actually. So does this link preview actually generate a click that goes to the website and will count towards their ad, you know, ad views or whatever? If it doesn't, then that's kind of messed up. Or is it taking that information from some cache that they have and it's just like spitting back the information it has to you? I think that's a real danger here, because the whole thing about Google's previews, like the site summaries that they do at the top of search, is here's the basic gist of what you're trying to ask. It gives you the information. How often are you actually clicking back into the site links to go there? It's the same thing. And to me, it's potentially less dangerous because not everyone's going to do link previews. I have to say, I use some Chrome extensions that give me, if I hold down my my pointer on a link, it pops up the page in a little window. Mm-hmm. And I can scroll that up and down really quickly. So it doesn't summarize it. Just give me like, hey, what's going on over there? And I can go in and see real quick. To me, that's useful, especially when doing stuff like looking through a game guide or something where I just need to peek at some information. I don't need to like completely change this page I'm on. So there are a lot of ways to do it. The key here is that it is giving you an AI summary of what's in there. And that's the sort of thing where I could see the problems here. And I don't think we can do much to avoid it, because Google has made it the de facto thing. Firefox is going to make it a thing that's going to be a part of, Mozilla is going to make it a part of Firefox. It's certainly going to be a thing built into Chrome eventually too. Because of the capacity for generative AI to just summarize stuff and do it pretty well, it's one of those things where everybody wants to do it because it's like a wonderful magic trick. Nobody wants to read long emails. Nobody wants to do a long article. You want a quick summary up top. In a lot of ways, that is a good usability thing too. A lot of websites have done that too, where the news articles will list key points up top and then you go down and read the whole thing at the bottom because people glance at information. The problem is website owners cannot make money from this, unfortunately. Like, this really devalues the whole thing.
Yeah, what we're talking about is less traffic overall. And there was an interview on another tech website talking with Sundar Pichai about whether or not Gemini puts more traffic out to the larger web. And Sundar was like, well, it goes to like a greater variety of websites, like very much sidestepping the question. And here we get to, I think, the higher news analysis bit of it, which is what we're starting to talk about is zero-click web searches. A situation where you're going to maybe ChatGPT or Claude or, you know, any of the other chatbots, you're asking a question as if it was a question. You're not using, you know, kind of the dumbed down sentence structure search terms that Google has taught us to do over the last 10 or so years. You know, best barbecue grill Reddit. And so you are asking this question, you are getting a response back, and you are not going to any other links. The only website that you went to was Google or ChatGPT or any of these other places. That can be a huge problem for other websites, especially news websites.
And that's just because that's the way the internet has worked for a long time since the rise of online ads. Like, that's it. And this, what we're seeing is sort of like what happened when, you know, Craigslist and the internet came out and it killed newspaper ads and it killed newspaper listings. And there maybe we have to rethink the way the economies of the internet works. But it is unfortunate that essentially these multi-billion dollar, $100 billion companies are out there just creating stuff that will hurt small media companies. That's why we're seeing a lot of news about media organizations forming deals, like licensing deals with these companies, with OpenAI and everybody, because that's the only way to get paid for essentially opening up your content to them. But it's still not a great long-term thing. It's not going to make you the money AdSense used to.
And I saw recently in Semaphore, Ben Smith used to work at BuzzFeed, big-time media columnist, used to have...
used to run BuzzFeed, yeah.
I mean, yeah, used to run BuzzFeed, used to write the media column at the New York Times. He was talking about a little quirk in a lot of chatbot responses recently that said that if you want a higher ranking in some of these chatbot responses, you actually have to have an article written about it. And so maybe like PR is more important to get things placed in high impact newspapers. Do I believe that this dynamic is going to work long term? No, this paradigm is going to shift, I think, very soon. Can I go off a little bit more on what I think could happen sometime in the future?
Sure.
Am I allowed? So I think the logic of SEO is going to continue going into the new AI and chatbot.
It'll be AI realm. SEO. Basically.
It will be AI SEO. And so let's imagine that you go immediately to your favorite chatbot, whatever it is, and you heard some information about a new diet or something, and you're like, okay, is this new diet healthy? Of course, it has, you know, a catchy two or three word name. And so you can go off and like ask that question, and the chatbot will say, of course, it's very, very healthy. And then there will be a little footnote that says that most of this information came from carnivorediet.com.
Yeah.
Because, and we have someone in the chat, I think it was Lucky Dog Podcast in the live stream chat, that said, oh, I like that Google's AI previews cite their sources. Who looks at the cited sources all that much? Or are you really just skimming very quickly the biggest possible text on the page?
It's the least they can do. It's the least they can do to put some sources down there. Yeah.
Then there's a question of kind of like user experience and like front end development. How are you presenting the information? Because you want the information like from the chatbot or whatever it finds on the web to be the biggest thing. That's the thing that people are looking for. And then maybe the footnotes, but I feel like the footnotes are going to get smaller and smaller, especially as there's some kind of dollar and cent incentive to maybe not talk so much about where the chatbot is getting its information. And it might be like contracts directly, or it might be lawsuits. So it's like, oh, actually, you know, this is coming up de novo, or like we are using an imprint of the web that we downloaded before some lawsuit that came up. And we're talking about, you know, 18 months in the future now, if not longer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is a transitional period. We don't know what the heck is going to happen. But what we are seeing is a widespread decimation of the online media industry in general. Look at what's happening to video game websites. The folks that can survive are either like enormous like IGN or people get fired. Look at what happened to Polygon. That is such a heartbreaking thing. You know, great sites being sold to content farms, essentially. And then the people there, the only way for them to survive is to essentially create their own, either their own email list or their own like self-run site. Not everyone's going to be able to do that. The best people, you know, the best people are doing that right now, but it's a shame because we're going to lose a lot of voices and lose a lot of media, and those folks aren't going to be able to like always pay freelancers the way a big media site used to. So we don't have answers. It's just like what I see happening, especially with AI, is that I just see more problems in an already messy online environment because, hey, online advertising has been tanking for years. We've seen crazy things like a decade ago, Facebook was like, hey, move all your video over to our servers and let's do Facebook video. And then people completely, including Yahoo, completely moved their video teams around that and built around that and kind of devalued YouTube a bit. And then a little bit later, Facebook was like, our bad. We don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Whoops. And also they didn't count the views properly too, I believe.
On purpose.
So anyway, I'm sort of saying I'm tired of being at the whims of these giant tech companies. And
that's pretty much like the summary of this whole podcast.
That's where we are.
But AI really is the big sad thing. That we built such a vibrant information ecosystem. And it seems like what's happening now is these large companies are trying to make it so you don't go to anywhere but their websites, and then they'll just crib all of the information from the larger web. But how is anybody going to make money to put new information on the larger web if you're only going to these three websites?
It remains to be seen. So, and I will say, like, sometimes this is something I encounter. Like, I'm like prepping my kids' lunch, and I have 10 minutes before I have to get them in the car, and I'd be like, how long does salami last after you open the package? You know, it's like, I don't have the time to like always open up and do a search look in the browser and do like some searching around. So now like we can just say, because my AirPods are in my ear, I can be like, hey, you know, virtual assistant, how long does salami last after you open it? And then I got a pretty decent response that was enough to be like, I'm going to throw this out. That's all I need to know. I didn't need to know anything beyond that. It's like, I'm not going to take a chance on salami that's over a month old, basically, even though it's a cured meat. So stuff like that, that I think is useful. That stuff is genuinely useful. The AI tools can be good. It's just there are all sorts of other parts of this whole media ecosystem that we're not really thinking about. And I'm kind of worried about like what we'll see with AI browsers. I will ping Opera. I have not tried Neon yet. The Arc browser Dia thing is not coming anytime soon. But the news behind that is that essentially they're stopping development of the Arc browser. They're not going to kill it. And they're also not going to open source it, which I saw people talking about in the chat, because apparently they're using technology from part of their protocols that they developed for the Arc browser. They're putting into Dia.
Yeah, web I remember people were saying, oh, really if you're different. Not going to like touch this anymore, why don't you open source it? That would be nice.
Yeah, but because no, the bones of what they built for Arc are going to be with India, essentially. And hey, Firefox is doing AI previews, so at least you don't have to, you know, work with that. I still think, you know, for the longest time, I thought Firefox was like dying because Chrome was good, and then Chrome became a memory hog. And now it's like I'm back to Firefox because everything is Chromium based and there are weird bugs all over my Windows install because of that. So I don't know what's happening, except prepare for browsers to look very different in the future. I think that's the main takeaway we can get from this. Anything else you want to add, Ben?
No. Devinder, how do you feel about Grok in Telegram?
Sure, whatever, man. Elon Musk, XAI is paying
Telegram I got a better segue. Firefox gets a lot of money from Google, like almost all of its operating budget from Google these days. I don't know how Telegram makes its money. I do know that it is a distant second when it comes to secure, like, messaging, text messaging sort of stuff. So I can only imagine that maybe this could be a similar, like, let's establish a vassal app, basically. Here's $300 million to use Grok, and Telegram makes money while its founder is still embroiled in some terrible case where they can't leave France.
Yeah, because Telegram ended up becoming a de facto platform for a lot of like illicit things to be happening. But yeah, the basic news is that XAI is paying Grok, paying Telegram $300 million to use Grok. The deal is kind of interesting. The $300 million covers a single year, and XAI will evenly split any subscription sales to Grok Premium and Premium Plus within Telegram. So Telegram is making a lot of money. This is only $300 million for a year as well, so this is probably good for them. This isn't like a 5 or 10 year deal. I have not really spent much time with Grok because I hate being on X. I think it's all gross, but it is funny to see all the many ways Grok has failed. People who do actually dabble in AI stuff say that Grok has gotten better over time, except for the weird stuff like you know,
how they were talking about
white genocide in South Africa.
Genocide?
Yeah, that's fun.
I can tell you anecdotally,
I wonder who did that.
That I have seen the trailheads for a couple of crypto scams. In fact, I've gone down that path a little bit, knowing, this is probably a crypto scam, but I'm going to see where it leads me. And they always ask me, hey, can we chat more on Telegram? It's not Signal. It's not like any other app. I don't know why they love Telegram so much, but Telegram seems to be the app for crypto scams. Do with that information what you will.
In other news, we saw, just a quick note here, Apple's self-service repair program is now extending to the iPad. So that's cool. If you have an old iPad, you want to try to fix them some, you know, in some ways. Supported iPad models are the iPad Air, M2 and later, iPad Pro, M4. Mini with the A17 Pro and the entry-level iPad A16. So Apple says it's going to offer displays, batteries, cameras, external charging ports to be used in repairs for out-of-warranty products. This is great because I've talked about this before. iPads are just kind of like tanks and they will just keep ticking. And to be able to like spend a bit of money and just fix an iPad on your own, that's kind of cool. My whole thing is getting that screen off. Because essentially what you see in iPhone and iPad repair shops, like there's some suction, there's a suction device that you have to use. You have to like loosen the glue, use the suction device and like suck it out. And to me, that process seems like a nightmare. But also home tinkers, I've seen them do crazier things. So I'm sure they'll figure out some way to deal with it.
I mean, a long time ago, I wanted to, why did I want to open up my iPod, but I did, and I remembered that I needed to like buy this little plastic, the tool had a very specific name, a non-marring pry tool, because Apple gadgets are so like hermetically sealed,
a plastic wedge.
What I can only imagine though is that some people might try to order these kits so that they can do the repairs on their own, find out that they're out of their depth, and I am not making a knock against anyone who is intrepid enough to do this, and then bring the kit and everything to the Genius Bar and hope that maybe they can do it like in front of them or something. If you are listening and this has happened, if you work at the Genius Bar at any Apple store, please hit our line at podcast@engadget.com.
I'm sure that'll happen. Just like, yeah, as an IT guy, like I've seen people come in with all sorts of stuff. Like, hey, I started this and this is not going well. But that happens all the time. That happens to handymen. That happens to plumbers. Like, I started this home improvement fix and help.
Yes.
Please.
Yeah,
help.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm not too surprised by that. But hey, good news overall. We also saw something. Apple's rumored to be releasing, basically rumored to be changing its number scheme for operating systems. This one's coming from Mark Gurman, but apparently at WWDC, Apple may be releasing iOS 26 this year, not iOS 19.
Would it be this year or next year? Oh, because right now we're at 18.5, and so maybe it would just go to 26?
No, so the way car years work, right? You announce a car, and it covers basically to the following year. And it seems like that's going to be the strategy for all of their software names. So we could soon see iPad OS 26, Mac OS 26, everything jumping up to 26. Even though a lot of those software generations are much, much younger. That's kind of funny. I think this is probably a good change because I hate the OS names. Just like I hate the A series chip names too. It's really hard to keep track of what's what. This is a good way to know if you're running the software, the current software, last year's software, which year's software are you running? A very quick and easy way to figure this out.
There's no unified understanding of like which OS you're using because there's like Apple TV OS, there's iOS, there's now like Vision Pro OS. So if you can have that like standardized, that makes sense. The other side of it though is, there is a contingent of people who think, you know what, we should be doing software a little slower and be making like huge changes from version to version versus like...
Who is saying that in the year 2025?
An economist writer, an economist tech writer that I follow. I mean, kind of like that idea rather than like iOS 2K26, but I don't know.
That is not the way, unfortunately. Like everything is basically
not the way.
That is not the way. Is from what I've seen, like what Microsoft did is it sped up Windows updates. Apple, has been doing quicker iPad updates. Microsoft used to be like every 3 or 4 years, maybe you'll get like a big massive update, but it took too long to fix problems. And it really took too long to introduce new features and really test things out. So you have to be faster. You have to be more nimble. I get that idea. It's sort of like it's a very idealistic way of thinking of deploying software updates. But man, stuff changes so quickly. Security patches have to roll out so quickly. I just feel like you have to be able to be nimble. That's kind of the way it goes. So I'm just saying this, what Apple is doing, if Apple ends up doing this, this totally makes sense. This makes life easier for us as we write about these things, for customers, as they try to figure out what they're running, for anybody supporting them. Like, this is net good to me. The only thing is, in 100 years, what's Apple going to do? They're really going to be in a Y2K situation here if we're just going with the final year.
They'll figure something else out.
Will humanity even exist, or will the AI have already taken over by then?
We'll all be paperclips by then.
Oh man. Anyway, that's kind of fun. I did not expect to hear some of that, but we'll see. We'll talk more about that leading up to WWDC in next week's show, and then our WWDC episode will be in a couple of weeks, so tune in for that. Let's move on to what we're working on. And hey, I just wrote up a review of the Volkswagen ID Buzz. This is their electric, you call it a microbus technically, because it's not a minibus. A minibus is those like larger car transport things, or the things that could hold like 12 people. This is their EV version of their classic microbus. There are a lot of things I like about it. It has a lot of room. It's really easy to drive. It's a real head turner because everybody who saw us driving this for the past week just could not help but stop me and ask questions about it. It looks really cool. But my God, this thing starts at $60,000 and actually higher at most dealers, which is a lot. Let me just put that in perspective. Like the Toyota Sienna, which is a hybrid minivan, that typically goes for around $50,000 now. And people consider that too much because you're paying luxury car prices for a Toyota. This thing is even more expensive. It's in line with the Kia EV9, but the problem is that this thing only has an estimated 234 miles of range, which is really, really low for a modern EV. You can get the Kia EV9 for basically the same price with a 300 mile range, which makes it more useful for road trips, Also, electric cars, batteries kind of go, they get wonky in extreme heat and also extreme cold. So your range goes all over the place. So if you have already a low starting range, that could be a bigger problem in the winter where you're, you know, heating things up and your battery is also stressing because of the cold, and you may see that range reduced even more. So that's a big problem for such a big, expensive car. I don't know. What do you think about this thing, Ben? Is it cute? Do you like it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful vibes machine. I think I saw one on California Route 1 when I was in the Bay Area a few months ago. But that makes so much sense. There's a lot of money flying around there. And also, you don't have to worry all that much about huge swings in temperature.
Basically. I mean, that's basically it. But also, If the money is not a huge issue for you, then yeah, this is kind of the only all-electric, seven-seater, minivan-like vehicle in America. In China, there are EV minivans. BYD, I believe, has produced a couple at this point. But we don't really have anything else in the U.S. You either have this, or you have a three-row big SUV like the Kia EV9, the new IONIQ 9, or the Rivian R1S. And I've driven two of those other cars. They're great. They're also expensive. The Rivian starts at $80,000. The Kia is great. The Kia is genuinely great. The nice thing about the ID. Buzz is that you have the second row sliding doors like a minivan, which is great if you have kids. It's great in tight parking spaces, especially like grocery stores and stuff. That stuff just makes it so convenient. It is a real, this Buzz is a really easy vehicle to live with. I wish it was cheaper. I wish the range was better. So I cannot like make this a recommended car for us. I will say this in our review, though. In a couple of years, EV prices do not hold. Like, EV prices fall like a rocket. I'm looking at a Polestar 2 right now, which originally retailed for $75,000. Use 20,000 at like 40,000 miles. That's ridiculous. So,
wow. When this 20,000, thing, 20,000?
$20,000 wow. For a $75,000 car that's only 3 years old. When in 3 years, when this thing hits the used market, I could see prices going between 30,000 and 40,000, and then we're cooking. Then we can talk about like what's an affordable car for a lot of people. Even if the range is low, most families aren't going to be doing road trips all the time. Maybe you can live with that, especially as charging infrastructure gets better. But for 90% of your living, your daily living, like a 230-mile car is actually pretty good.
I think for all like the time,
taking kids to soccer games and stuff. Yeah.
About the runs that my mom did. She did school pickup all the time.
Yep.
And so she would go from my middle school to my brother's elementary school to the grocery store to like a couple of other places. She was like a Cub Scout mom. And so everything that she did was so inside the plug-in hybrid range. Like,
basically,
if that existed when she was doing school pickup, she would have never paid for gas, except for stuff that happened on the weekends. If we would like go up and visit family in Poughkeepsie, because I grew up around the New York area, that's the only time that we would end up using gas. And
lot of plug-in hybrids right now get like 30 to 50 miles of EV charge. Mm-hmm. So that's like great. Great for your daily commute, essentially.
Literally.
Doing stuff mainly locally. So that's still an option. Hey, Volvo, like they are releasing something in China, the XC70. That is going to be, it's like 200, it's a plug-in hybrid, but it also has 200 miles of EV range, which is ridiculous. So it can still run gas, but also gets you up to 200 miles. It's only going to be in China so far. But when you have something like that, you're like, how can Volvo do that? And you are an enormous VW microbus, and you can't fit in more batteries, you know, effectively, cost effectively. Like, I don't understand the argument here. So to me, there are many issues here. I have seen some commenters like, what's his name? Linus Tech Tips, I believe, says he's already put money down to pre-order. Sure, money doesn't matter to him.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Also, when you have a big YouTube channel, you can take that off on your taxes.
That's actually a great video crew van. Like, get your whole crew around.
Oh, absolutely.
Take it anywhere. Load up cargo space, and this was enormous. We had to do like a kid toy donation run, which included a sort of like bike, a thing you attach to your bike for the kids to sit in, which is huge and has a weird unwieldy thing to attach to the bike, was able to fit in the trunk, and also a high chair we had to donate. So like a ton of stuff all at once, make it one trip. That's great, because we have a Volvo XC90, which is a 3-year SUV. That thing still wouldn't, it would not have fit the amount of stuff we plugged in there. So it is helpful to have a big family car like this. It's just not quite there. It's too expensive, not enough range. So that's my feelings on that. Anything you want to shout out, Ben, that you're working on?
No, let's go to picks.
Let's go. Let's go. Okay. Pop culture picks for the week. I already mentioned this, but I've been reading Karen Howe's Empire of AI book. Actually listening to the audiobook because I never have time to just sit down and read, which is unfortunate. But she's narrating the audiobook. This thing is great. This thing is essential. If you have enjoyed any of our conversations about AI, I think it's worth listening to, because she has had in-depth knowledge of OpenAI for years. She's been, you know, reporting about AI long before ChatGPT, long before people actually cared about this stuff. And it is kind of wild to see the portrait of OpenAI that she's painting is essentially they are just like weird religious zealots for AI. They may have some technical skills, but what is leading them is like, AGI is coming. We must prepare for the coming of our Lord. And it is frightening that that is the driving force behind a lot of these companies.
I Sam watched Altman an interview is the guy who's just like, with her, yeah. with Adam Conover, that came out just yesterday. And it was interesting. You know, the title of the book says Empire of AI. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, they did build a business empire. No, like, it goes deeper than that. Like, she's talking about how, like, yeah, empires of old were built. And she uses the term, like, civilizing mission when it comes to, like, the central logic of each of these companies, OpenAI and Anthropic and all of that. And it's literally, like, a one-to-one ratio or a one-to-one comparison of the various empires of the 17 and 1800s saying, you know, we're the French, we are more moral than the British or the Dutch, we should be conquering the whole world, or we should be setting up colonies around the whole world because we are the most moral of them. Same idea. We must produce AI because we are the ones that are moral enough to do it. They are self-appointing themselves as moral enough.
Yep. And it's you get the history too of like how much it's just like kind of BS that OpenAI was saying, look, we're going to build like good AI to get away from the bad AI. It was always a framing. It was always a thing they were ready to abandon in an instant as soon as it suited them. It also paints Sam Altman as this guy who's just like, he is apparently a smart guy that a lot of people like to schmooze with. He's very manipulative in terms of like getting what he wants by trying to basically like he pretends to listen to people, but he does a good job of just always telling people what they want to hear. So he has that sort of like politician knack to him. Apparently he was thinking about running for California governor at one point because they're like, oh yeah, you're good, you're really good, one of these folks, yeah, you know who's good at that, politicians.
Yeah,
let's
just
make
a
one of them.
Good talker. I heard Karen Howe call him a once in a generation storyteller.
I hate that term, especially we just made fun of the video where he couldn't even have a cup of coffee with Johnny Ive, but this man is a once in a generation storyteller. Anyway,
have you heard the kind of conspiracy theory that whole video may have been AI?
that's a conspiracy theory.
Yes,
but
no,
it is
100% a conspiracy theory, but like
it is as unnatural as like AI stuff that we've seen. Anyway, the book is very good, Empire of AI. Listen to the audiobook, read the book. I'm hoping to chat with Karen next week so we can ask her some questions. So actually, if you have any questions for Karen Howe, drop us an email, podcast@engadget.com. And yeah, that's my pick. Anything you want to shout out, Ben?
Oh boy, do I have some things that I want to shout out. I don't usually get to do this, so can I have two, please?
Okay.
The first one is, if you miss old internet, if you miss kind of art projects and kind of storytelling worlds that existed more for the fun of it and then also to make money rather than it seemed like it, you know, fit very well into the content flywheel, go and check out this YouTube account, TikTok account, Instagram account called Mummy Joe. That's MUMMY_JOE. It might remind you a little bit of Homestar Runner, but only a little bit. it has such a clear artistic vision, and the characters are so delightful. Apparently, it only started like within the last year and a half, or maybe 2 years, and it's doing really well, at least in follower count. I'm hoping that it comes through in terms of like actual, you know, remunerative merch sales or whatever for the creator of this. I tried to see if there was anything I could find about the creator, but no, this person is mostly anonymous. If I had to guess, this is someone who worked for like Cartoon Network or one of the other, like, this person is experienced. They know how to create a world right from the get-go. And that's it's cool. So delightful to see. So check out Mummy Joe. Second thing,
Mummy Joe.
If you liked Sinners, I'm not going to do any spoilers for Sinners, but you should check out this novella called Ring Shout. It's by an author. I think his name is P. Jalet Clark. It is so good. It is all killer, no filler, because it is such a short book. Novellas have no time to spend, you know, doing little side quests or doing any world building that is not absolutely necessary for the story. So imagine a girl gang, a group of black women in the 1920s who are hunting Ku Klux Klan members. But the Ku Klux Klan members, if there is enough hate inside of them, they end up, their bodies get, you know, their human bodies get hollowed out and they become demons. And these three women have the sight. They can tell who are the Ku Kluxes.
This is a Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
It is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There's a little bit of an element of the three main women feel a bit like Garnet, Amethyst, and Pearl from Steven Universe. So they are hunting these Ku Kluxes. The Ku Kluxes are the demons. And then they're like, oh, yeah, and we like don't really bother with the clan members because the clan members, they're just humans, and we, you know, made a vow not to kill humans.
That's convenient.
They have a old Gullah woman who's basically their Professor X. I have just hit the climax. Again, I don't think it's really spoilers. The climax has something to do with a screening of The Birth of a Nation Mountain in Georgia.
Yeah. Like 20 minutes from me, baby.
Oh, my goodness. It is a great, fun time. I've been listening to the audiobook. It's fantastic.
And I got to check this out.
Yeah, go check this out. It is so much fun.
What's it called again?
Ring Shout. There's a sword that comes out of nowhere. There's a council of, they're basically the fates. One of the women has a relationship with this like council of the fates, but it also, you know, they're inscrutable. They talk in riddles. It kind of reminds me of the general concept of the board, like from Control. And everybody who's listened to this podcast for long enough knows that I love Control.
We all love Control in this house.
So check out Ring Shout. I really hope that it will come to screens sometime in the future, because you know from reading just a chapter of this that this was meant to be adapted. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Blue Sky, and a podcast about TV and movies at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to hear my increasingly curmudgeonly takes about all sorts of things, find me on Blue Sky at heybellman.bluesky, whatever. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
Thanks, folks. We're out.